All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, March 4th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. It is a balmy 26 degrees and snowing lightly here in upstate New York. I'm having major technical problems, and of course started 5 minutes before the show went live. My entire show was put together not on one, but two machines, and both machines went into flash crash, complete, utter blow-up destruction mode. I thought I was going to be smart, so I did have every single one of those links stored separately, so worst case scenario, I could just go back and rebuild them. But I had to reboot that machine. And now the machine's trying to come back up again. So I don't know, guys. I almost put on a rebroad because I think it might be almost impossible to do this show. So I guess we're going to have to see how this goes. Because right now I got nothing. Except two broken computers. But, well, hold on. Maybe I can't even get to my... I have to tell you, every single day, it's more and more challenging considering that, you know, I got tons of stress in my life. The network being a number one that I could be doing without. A number two, I have my home. I have my life. I mean, I'd like to do something maybe every once in a while. I don't know. Some days I just say, why? Why am I even doing this anymore? Oh, son of a... Do I remember my password? Oh, so good start. Makes me want to go do something fun. All right. Well, we can see. All right. So where do we leave off yesterday? We'll see if something works here. We titled the show Brain, DARPA, Stress, Memory, and ex-Google CEO helping the DOD. And that was Eric Schmidt, has now hopped on board to help the Department of Defense with their hacker event that they have going on. They typically do it every year. This is part of the RSA event. If I can find the story, and maybe I don't even know if it's part of anything I link to. Holy son of a what? Everything is dead on two machines, but just it was perfect till 5 minutes before the show went live, and then everything just went completely haywire. It's just amazing. I wish I was a betting lottery type person because I think I'd be rich by now with the type of luck that I have on these two not even that old machines that don't have anything much on them except for me cutting audio. All right, let's see if I can get there now. I had to fully reboot a machine. I lost everything I had for links in the name of the fact that there was 5 minutes left until showtime. So I said, screw it and just shut it all down. Copy. See, days like today, I think are better, well better served with my ass in bed and my eyes closed. Oh, now that I've waved my fist at it, just as the fully rebooted computer now is going to bring up the story, the original story goes bloop. Oh, here I. Sorry, I said flash crash, couldn't load. I'm back now. All right, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt is now on a military advisory board for the Pentagon. Eric Schmidt, the former chief executive officer of Google, has agreed to head a new Pentagon advisory board aimed at bringing Silicon Valley innovation and best practices to the U.S. military, says Defense Secretary Ashton Carter on Wednesday. Carter is due to discuss the new Defense Innovation Advisory Board with Schmidt during the annual RSA Cybersecurity Conference in San Francisco. And of course, Obama just recently inked his big old cybersecurity bill. You know, be afraid, be very afraid. Hackers are everywhere. We need to merge governments and corporate America. Because look at how many breaches there have been, data breaches. How many letters have you gotten saying that your healthcare provider has been hacked? Or your bank or your mortgage company or the amusement park you took the kids to last year, who tracked all your info while you were walking around with your Fitbit bracelet. I don't know. But it just seems like out of the blue, there were just hackers. Hackers everywhere stealing information all over the place. And now you and me, we've been targets. Every corporation in America is now a target. And the only way to keep you safe is to merge with the federal enterprises. Let's get corporate CEOs into the government and let's share information and let's all butt pat. And it'll be a big, happy, safe family as DARPA Dan works on the new Sentry software that will attack and destroy future hackers autonomously. Anyway, so Schmidt is now the executive chairman of Alphabet Inc. So he stepped down as CEO of Google, and he is now the executive chairman of the big conglomerate company, not just Google, but Alphabet. Remember, life science division, nanotechnology, robotics, Atlas too. They're all part of the same company, and good old Eric Schmidt, executive chairman of Alphabet, is now working with the Department of Defense. How come nobody is standing up saying, what the F, Chuck? Because I know I am. Like I said, there's a picture of I always forget his name, Schmidt, looking like he's going to be all kissy-faced with Obama there, chummy bosom buddies. The newborn is Carter's latest effort to kickstart innovation across the U.S. military by building bridges to the U.S. technology industry. The U.S. defense chief announced the board's creation on Wednesday, so it was just a couple days ago, during his trip to Silicon Valley. And Carter and Schmidt will select up to 12 individuals to serve on the board, focusing on people who have led large private and public organizations and excelled at identifying and adapting new technology concepts, says the Pentagon. Modeled on the Defense Business Board, which provides advice on best business practices from the private sector, the new panel is intended to help the Pentagon become more innovative and adaptive in developing technology and more nimble. And, you know, they're salivating. We read an interview a few days ago from, I don't remember her name, Akprag Big Mid. The woman who's in charge of DARPA, she has a really long, stringy name. And she was saying how excited she was to be able to work now with technology companies like Google, let them put all the money into application development and hardware development and get it all working just fine, because that's what they want to do. And then Google can take it, or DARPA can take it off the shelf, make some modifications to it, and use it for their own uses. It says, anyway, so they want to become more innovative, adaptive in developing technology, more nimble. Members will draw on their experience in Silicon Valley to advise on rapid prototyping, iterative product development, complete data analysis, the use of mobile and cloud applications, and the organizational informational sharing. And of course, that's what the cloud is all about. The secretary is also looking at ways to keep the department thinking fresh, bringing in new ideas, bringing in new voices, and he sees this as another opportunity to do just that. And what's interesting is that there's another story about this out there. If I can find it, I don't know if it's still out there. Hold on. Let's see if I can find this one. Because what was interesting is that that was just a tiny little drop in the bucket of the story. And I don't know if I have it, so we might just have to skip it. Well, this sucks. I really hate when this happens. And, you know, they make me feel very discouraged. Like, I don't even know why I take the time and effort to do the show, since it takes me literally 3 to 4 hours every single day of my time that I can never get back again to have 21 views on something after all this stress and all the bullshit. It just doesn't seem like it's worth it. And because I spend all this time and effort doing this, I can't write stories either, because I just don't plumb have any time or mental capacity left after that fact. And if I were writing stories, that at least would be helping to finance the network, at least pay for something, since there's zero paying for anything except for my aggravation. All right, bug bounty. Pentagon invites hackers to attack DOD. So this is this RSA conference. They're begging hackers to hack them. Careful what you ask for. Pentagon, and this is the program that Eric Schmidt's going to be in charge of. The Pentagon is launching a new program, and notice how that other story didn't say anything about this, is launching a new program that invites hackers to attack Department of Defense websites for possible financial rewards, dangling carrot, such as bug bounty program in the federal government. The program, which begins in April, essentially involves the Pentagon selecting a group of hackers, giving them departments to target, and then asking them to do as much damage as possible, and then report back to what they found to help the DOD in patching those holes in exchange for some kind of reward. I am always challenging our people to think outside the five-sided box that is the Pentagon. Says Secretary of Defense Ash Carter in a statement, and inviting responsible hackers to help us test our cybersecurity certainly meets that test. I am confident this innovative initiative will strengthen our digital defense and ultimately enhance our national security. You know, you gotta wonder, though, if you're going to be a hacker that comes out of the shadows because there's this promise of financial reward by the Department of Defense. And, of course, you know, ever since that 1980s movie, I don't remember what it was called, but you remember they simulated nuclear war on the screen? The hackers did, making them think that Russia and us were in nuclear war. That wasn't even that movie. But, you know, if you remember, it's not like happy hackers like that anymore necessarily. You know, we got people who really do want to do some malicious stuff out there from different corners of the world. Lots of countries that really dislike us right now. And, you know, honestly, there are probably some hackers right here in the United States that would love to be able to do some hurt on a federal enterprise through the internet. But don't think for 1 second that this may not be a ploy, especially with financial rewards at the other end. For the White House as well. They bug bounty for the White House. Don't you think for 1 second, you know, they might be giving you financial reward, but they're also at that point in time, once they identify you and your location and put that like red tag on you that you're a hacker, boop, 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 boop. Don't think for 1 second that a monster, a behemoth agency such as some of Keith Alexander's former employees aren't going to be jumping all over your gear and doing a big sucking crawl of everything you own trust me, because that's happened to me here. That happens to me here every once in a, I'm just going to say a blue moon, but it's a lot more often than that. Where every computer here, every computer, and it's not my connection, it's my machine, gets taken to its knees by something. You know, this isn't me being like an idiot downloading stuff and not knowing what I'm doing. I've been doing this stuff for a long time. And this has just been over the last few years that I've been having these ridiculously idiotic, completely bizarre, without explanation problems that I've just come to accept now. I don't let them make me feel like getting out the baseball bat anymore. I used to. But if you take that dangling carrot because the feds are offering you fame and fortune, you become a part of their machine. And anything that you have done in the past now becomes a part of their dossier on you if they didn't already know about it before. It's like getting the insects to come out from behind the wall before they give you a big dose of pesticide. So all I'm saying is be careful. I know when I read this, I was like, oh, here we go again. Oh, they're getting the hackers to come out. And I mean, they do this at a couple different events. You know, you got the Black Hat event. I don't know if this is in San Francisco. That Black Hat's usually in like Nevada. You know, a lot of my friends back in the day, I mean, you, even back in that 80s movie, and I wish I remembered what it was called, Cupid Doll, anybody, do you remember when they simulated the nuclear war? And as the computer that came out and said, can you, or do you want to play a game? Whatever it was. But I guess no one in chat's paying attention. Anyway, so let's go on to the rest of the story. Participants will need to be registered and vetted, although a senior defense official says that the process for how they will be tested is still being worked out. Yes, you're going to have to go through a criminal background check, strip down, bend over for your internal exam, and then we'll decide whether or not we're going to allow you to hack the Pentagon without throwing you in some black box jail for the rest of your life. All participants, of course, must be U.S. citizens, and the official speaking on the background ahead of the official announcement said that the hope is eventually to have participant numbers in the thousands, but that wasn't actually a target. So thousands of hackers working on hacking the Pentagon for some cash, for some taxpayer dollars. And you know, of course, once they identify who the good hackers are, who the people are with talent, they're going to be able to use them now to join their new NSA 21 division. I think we read about that the other day, where there's the merging of our former external hacking team that used to do things such as espionage against other countries. And they have now merged with our internal NSA. And I see, actually, it looks like that announcement first came in December. But it has happened. And they're going to know everything about you. Anyway, let's finish the story now. Bug Bounty, as these programs are known, have become commonplace in the tech sector. The website bugcrowd.com maintains a list of more than 470 companies that have such a program, including giants like Google, Microsoft, PayPal, and Yahoo. But the federal government has not yet embraced this idea, which the official called best practice that should help the DoD identify weak spots that are already under pressure. We are constantly under attack, and I can't possibly empathize, that is when it says that anymore, so it doesn't really make sense. It should be emphasize. Just like we have war fighters that are constantly under attack, our systems and networks are constantly being attacked here, said the official, and nobody who is a bad guy, is waiting around for us to introduce Bug Bounty to go after a DOD effort. They are not waiting. They are doing it right now. So, hey, what will be targeted? The official says that while final decisions are still being made, the target will be public-facing websites, major homepages like defense.gov or army.mil would seem to be likely targets, as would social media. And in January 2015, the U.S. Central Command's Twitter and YouTube accounts were hacked by people claiming affiliation with the Islamic State, commonly known as ISIS or ISIL or Daesh or whatever the some of the other names were. Part of the reason for choosing public sites is to protect anything mission critical from accidentally being affected, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, these are best practices. We know of all that. So notice, though, in the first story that we read, partially, once it finally loaded, they talk about bringing Eric Schmidt on to an advisory board to help the Pentagon. But they don't mention anything about the hackathon that he's going to be in charge of. And then another story comes out, and this is out of Defense News, defense industry publication, that talks about the hackathon, but doesn't mention CEO, former CEO, whatever he is now. He's the executive, what did they call him? The executive chairman of all of Alphabet. They don't mention anything about him coming on to help the DOD with this whole effort. Just seems odd and quite a big omission, you would have to say. And especially when we have then discussed many, 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 many connections between DARPA and Google, DARPA and mad science gone mad, DARPA and super soldiers and brain implants and always trying to help the PTSD patient. Easy pickings to be able to make them into guinea pigs. Here, take this injection we haven't fully tested yet or had FDA approved. I mean, you can definitely see that there are some disturbing connections. Well, here's something that I ran across the other day. I have not dug deep enough into this to know if DARPA or Google has anything to do with it. I would almost guarantee that they did, but I don't know for sure. So let's not say that. Let's just read about it in terror. Scientists successfully test biological supercomputer performing complex tasks. Yeah, I said it. A biological supercomputer. Researchers have taken on the problem of reducing a supercomputer to the size of a basketball field to that of a book. The answer is biocomputers, incredibly powerful machines capable of performing multiple calculations with just a fraction of the energy. According to study coordinator Heiner Linke, who heads nanoscience at Lund University in Sweden, a biocomputer requires less than 1% of the energy on an electronic transistor that needs to carry out one calculation step. A biocomputer is useful because ordinary computers are incapable of solving combinational problems such as those dealing with cryptography or other tasks requiring that a multitude of possible solutions be considered. Oh my God, is this one of those stories that's just like someone pulled out a thesaurus and it's just lots of mumbo jumbo garbledy that really isn't getting to the point? Anyway, parallel computers of this sort can run on molecular motors, and I had a couple news stories about the molecular motors made out of DNA. We've read about those. They're working on them at MIT, I believe, way back when. And now they actually have something, and that was probably so far back in my feed. I don't know, guys. It's, to be completely honest, I'm about at my capacity for being able to keep up on everything. And I don't know if you noticed, we brought on 4 new shows, soon to be 5, here starting next week. And it's just really, really been tough for me. and sent my body over the edge of stress-related issues. So I don't know. There might be some time off needing to come here very soon, so I don't fall off the deep end. Here we go. Biological supercomputers. Is that this one? Yeah. Oh well. Technical problems just day in, day out. I don't even care anymore. In simple terms, well, I almost don't even think I'm going to read this story because this story is just not well written. Let's read this other one. Energy efficient biocomputers provide viable alternative to quantum computers. Another story, same topic, but written in terms that are much easier to understand. A team of international scientists here, look right there. That's even more easy to understand. From Canada, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden announced on Friday, and this was last week, that they had developed a model, a biological supercomputer capable of solving complex mathematical problems using far less energy than standard electronic computers. Hey, look, we understand who's involved and why this is important in the first sentence. That's perfect. You get an A. The model biocomputer, which is roughly the size of a book, is powered by what? Oh, adenosine triphosphate, which is ATP, dubbed the molecular unit of currency. According to the description of this device published in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, the biocomputer uses proteins present in all living cells to function. It uses a strategy similar to that of quantum computers, which uses qubits, the quantum computing equivalent of a bit, to perform parallel computation, wherein computers are able to process the information quickly and accurately by performing several calculations simultaneously rather than sequentially. In the case of the biocomputer, the qubits are replaced with short strings of proteins. What? Powered by ATP, working in parallel. And as the researchers involved in the study explain, the circuit of a biocomputer looks a bit like a roadmap of a busy and very organized city as seen from a plane. In simple terms, it involves the building of a labyrinth of nano-based channels that have specific traffic regulations for protein filaments. And the solution in the labyrinth corresponds to the answer of a mathematical question and how many molecules can find their way through the labyrinth at the same time, says Heiner Linke. There he is, Heiner, director of nanoscience at Lund University in Sweden. Notice how they didn't mention that in the last story. The fact that molecules are very cheap. Molecules are very cheap. And that we now have shown the biocomputer's calculation work leads me to believe that biocomputers have the prerequisites for practical use within 10 years. Guys, we're talking biological computers. Now, if we look at Google DARPA, the whole Google DARPA merging in the machine Kurzweil 2045, and now Eric Schmidt going over to help the Department of Defense with their hacker thing. The fact that we got biological computing on the table should be extremely disturbing to every single one of us. How long is it going to be before we're using some sort of CRISPR-Cas9? And I mean, not saying that the human body isn't some sort of complex computer, because we are, and we're creating these little dumbed down versions that are using, you know, little energy portions of the cell or whatever to make things move around. But how long do you think it's going to be before we can start integrating, like, some of the biggest and the best? Remember the DARPA lady talking about how eventually she wanted to have a database of all the genomes of every living organism on this planet and be able, with the touch of a button, mix and match all their traits into some new organism to do something, to fix something? Well, we have a biological computer. We start adding like brains. Remember, we can make brains in a dish now. Little roly ball brains. We were reading about those last Friday. Eyeballs. Let's get some eyes on that puppy. And this is just frightening. It makes me think of some horrifying creature from a Doctor Who episode out in the middle of the universe. Star Trek episode 1965. According to researchers, the biocomputer would require less than 1% of the energy consumed by an electronic transistor, making them much more sustainable than electronic supercomputers, which often require their own power plant to function. Well, Rhodes says not in our lifetime. These guys are saying practical use within 10 years. It is also hard to say how soon it will be before we can see a full-scale bio supercomputer. One option for dealing with larger, more complex problems may be to combine our device with conventional computers to form a hybrid. Yeah, that's how we do it first. Remember, 2045 Project is not all about just uploading yourself to the cloud. There's an interim part to that, and that is implanting your brain into a robotic body. And then when they get that all perfected, then they can upload you to the cloud. It's all about baby steps, people. One option for dealing with the larger, more complex problems may be to combine our device with conventional computers to form a hybrid device, says Dan Nicolau from the Department of Engineering at Canada's McGill University in a statement. And right now we're working on a variety of ways to push this research further. You know, McGill University, there were two of the world's leading brain scientists that went to go work for Google. And some of their AI for the I'm trying to remember brain something, whatever the project is that Kurzweil's working on, his AI division. Remember, the search division just merged with the DeepMind project. That's what it was. So it should be interesting, as we have the same Canadian university now where those two top neuroscientists came from, left and went to Google, are working now on this bio computer. All right, well, speaking of deep learning, let's see if this sucker loads. And I doubt that it will, so hold on. Maybe I can find it. This is so frustrating. This is why, you know, I think they wait until Friday till I just don't have any fight left in me. Because really, by Friday, I just, there's no energy, no brain power. And I still have, like, another whole weekend of work to do until I can start all over again on Monday. It just never ends, guys. I work 7 straight days for as many hours as I can force myself to on a daily basis for nothing. For absolutely nothing, so I can have my family hate me. That's why. The mission to bring Google's AI to the rest of the world. Google, Microsoft, and Facebook are pioneering a new kind of artificial intelligence. At Google, it helps drive the voice recognition service that lets you search the web merely by talking into your Android. At Microsoft, it underpins the new Skype translation tool that lets you instantly communicate with people who speak another language. And at Facebook, and of course we just saw Zuckerberg with his whatever that conference was going on last week or the week before, where the entire room of techs had their new VR goggles on and no one even noticed Zuckerberg walking down the aisle. At Facebook, a newly assembled team of engineers is exploring how it might be used to recognize faces in online photos, and it is called deep learning. And this story is a little bit older. This is from 2014. So a lot of that's already happened. We read about DeepMind. We read about some of this deep learning computing in AI. Kurzweil, of course, was a big part of that, is a big part of that at Google. And that facial recognition software has gone up already a couple notches from 2014 as far as its ability to recognize and how frightening it is in the cloud. Anyway, it's called deep learning, and it seeks to remake computing by more closely mimicking the way human brains process information, giving machines more power to learn as time goes on. The technology has so much promise, and it has sparked a kind of arms race among the tech giants. Facebook and Google recently hired the two academics who originally laid out the concepts behind deep learning. And earlier this month, Chinese search giant Baidu, and remember Baidu, the guy who was part of the AI project in the very beginning at Google, left Google and went to Chinese search equivalent giant Baidu to help them work on their artificial intelligence project. But earlier this month, Chinese search giant Baidu followed suit when it snapped up another academic at the heart of the movement. But Adam Gibson, an independent software engineer based in San Francisco, does not want this new technology locked inside the biggest names on the net. He believes that deep learning techniques should be available to any website, company, or developer interested in using them. And that is why he has launched a brand new startup called SkyMind. Oh, yes, we need a company called SkyMind. SkyMind. Oh, you know, when you think about the stuff, these people just don't understand what they're doing. Talk about short-sightedness. SkyMind, Skynet, Sky, crazy electronic gods in the sky who see and hear everything. SkyMind. They have a website. SkyMind.io. We want to give people machine learning without them having to hire a data scientist, says Gibson, 24, a college dropout who has taught himself the vagaries of deep learning from public academic papers and has served as a kind of machine learning consultant for various companies while teaching courses on the subject through an outfit called Zipfian Academy. Alongside another engineer named Josh Patterson, who has previously worked for big data startup Cloudera, Gibson has built a new library of deep learning software tools that is freely available to anyone. And SkyMind will serve not only as a steward for this open source project. I might have to check this out. Maybe we'll build some deep learning into UCY. But as a consultant that will help others use the code to build their own AI-powered online services. Based on academic papers published by some of the deep learning engineers now working for Google and Facebook, the software could help power everything from voice recognition to language translation to the kind of automatic product recommendations when you visit Amazon. I could serve you up show archives based upon your past listening experiences. He says, we are trying to clone what Google does. And although the project is still in its early stages, the code is already capable of bringing deep learning techniques to live web services. We are handling production level systems, he says, while declining to name which companies are using it. And at the very least, we are able to reproduce the results the academic papers are producing. There are other ways of using deep learning. The academic community has found the movement offers its own open source software tools written by Python programming language, and these serve as a basis for Ezerat, a service that lets you tap deep learning algorithms via the internet. Based on software designed at Google, there's another company called Hadoop, and it's a way of storing and processing enormous amounts of data across hundreds of ordinary servers. And this sort of distributed computing power is what deep learning requires, right? It's making a fully distributed cloud, pretty much. It's actually, it's a good way so you don't lose a data center, let's say, if you had all your computers in one basket and then you got hit by a big fat tornado, that's not going to help with your cloud computing. They have to be all over the world. Or at least in a couple different locations. Anyway, what's the end result of the story? Let's scroll to the bottom. To be sure, algorithms championed by Gibson are still an awfully long way away from cloning the human brain, which means even the artificial intelligence moniker is a bit of a stretch, and SkyMind is still very much in its infancy. Yeah, well, it's 2 years ago. I'd like to know if they went public and how they're doing. But Google and Microsoft have already shown that deep learning can advance the state of the art, and with his startup, Gibson has at least identified the next logical step for his fledgling technology. So we were talking about open source the other day, so I wanted to bring that up because at least there is somebody out there that's working on open source AI and deep learning, though I'm not sure that those were exactly the technologies that we were looking for. To be out there and available to every single lunatic who is looking to rule the world. All right, I don't know. Where do we go next? This whole show kind of got screwed up because 5 minutes before we went live, you heard me. Everything broke. So I lost all my links. And I'm just kind of scrolling now through stuff that I posted, except that I can't even scroll properly because it's all choppy and I don't know. Something's happening here. Here's a good one. Another Google. Oh. Yay. If it loads. Oh, well, I'm just going to chill out here while this tries to load. I get flash crashes. That's their tool, by the way. That's like their flash bomb that they send me. I got flash bombed. It just completely blows up your browser. Completely. Machine goes to syrup to its knees. All my data is probably being scanned and sucked, and I really don't care. I mean, I don't do anything. I don't even have any porn for them to check out. All right. Google's new AI has a superhuman ability to locate when and where your image was taken. This was February 25th, 2016. If you've ever played the game GeoGuessr, you will know how hard it is to locate somewhere purely by an image. Well, don't worry about that anymore. Don't worry your pretty little head about that anymore, because you know what? We can help you out with that. And the online game GeoGuessr, oh God, plonks you into a random location on a Google Street View, and it's your job to determine where you are anywhere in the world only using the visible clues. But even as spatial creatures, as humans, we find it harder to tell our Australian outback from our African bush. I don't know, I might be all right doing that. Google has developed an artificial intelligence machine capable of, quote unquote, and this is exactly how they say it, superhuman levels of accuracy when it comes to guessing a location based on just the pixels of a photograph. Tobias Weyand, one of the brains at Google and a team who specializes in developing computer vision, have developed PlayNet, PlayNet, a deep neural network capable of determining where an image was taken purely on its pixels. To develop the computer spatial memory, the team fed in 91 million geotagged images, and using this data, they chopped up a map into a grid consisting over 26,000 square miles, with the size of the squares proportional to how many of the images have been shot there. Big cities with highly concentrated populations tended to make up more of the squares compared with rural areas, And as such, there were not enough images to include the ocean or the polar regions. Throughout this process, the deep neural network picks up on trends and visual clues that appear in photographs in the same grid, such as color, texture, and shape. And for example, the network could pick up on distinctive reds and browns in the Grand Canyon, blah, blah, blah. All right. And then to test it, of course, all the dumb people that uploaded their photos to the machine helped them out. And to test out the neural network, they gave 2.3 million geotagged photos from Flickr to see if they could guess where the image was taken. And the computer correctly guessed the continent of 48%, determined the country of 28.4%. And on top of the study, the claim it claims it can localize 3.76% of images at a street level with a 10.1% accuracy at the city level. While this may not sound massively accurate, it's a lot better than humans. The team put PlayNet up against 10 well-traveled human subjects, and PlayNet won 28 out of the 50 with an average error of only 1,131.7 kilometers, while the humans were off target by an average of 2,320.75 kilometers. So, remarkably, I don't know, this is another lame old story. I lost everything. I had all my robot stories to do. Remarkably, the researchers claim that PlayNet even has the ability to determine the location of images of indoor environments by picking up on specific items, says the MIT Technology Review. And you might think that humans would have an advantage, but in the absence of obvious and discriminative landmarks, humans can fall back on their world knowledge and use multiple clues to infer the location of a photo. And yeah, I mean, at some point here, you know, you do know that every time you take a photo on any of your newer digital devices, such as a phone or whatever, there are embedded in the photo geolocation data points already there. So like if you turn around and upload it, let's say to some anonymous photo sharing site, or even to your own Facebook, or throwing it into chat or whatever, that information is there for anyone who knows what to look for. Even though you don't identify your picture anywhere, they'll know exactly where that picture is taken based upon its geolocation code. So it's kind of a frightening thought. Just remember that anytime you do that, that information is going to be out there and you don't even know about it. So I don't know where to go from here since I really am having major problems. Maybe this story will load. I really hate shows like this. Makes it so difficult. There's no dopamine carrot at the end of the show that makes me want to come back and do it on Monday. Getting better at ignoring things makes you more efficient, says study. I thought to myself, I need to get better at ignoring everything. Nobody would like to think of themselves as being ignorant, but it turns out that not paying attention to things can be a benefit at times, according to a new study. Researchers in the U.S. have found that when people are told to ignore certain information, it makes them more efficient at performing particular visual tasks. And as we've been reading over the last week about how more and more information coming faster and faster and more stress and more use of our mobile devices causes us to forget facts and have a short attention span, not pay attention, have short-term and long-term memory issues because we're overburdened by information. What's the solution? Well, just start ignoring things, says study. You know, I mean, what kind of a solution is that? It's exactly what I have to do. You know, when just a warning, I work 7 days a week from the minute I wake up until about midnight or so on the clock. Off the clock, once the live shows go off the air, I'm usually up until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning trying to get a leg up start on stuff that needs to be cut or manipulating things on the website, moving around banners, making changes from the 1,200 things that somebody's asked me to change every single week on their page again. And when people start messaging me at like 2 o'clock in the morning with a change they want to their website or their show name or whatever, guess what I typically do? I ignore it, at least for that time being, because you know what? By 2 o'clock in the morning, I've about had enough, to be completely honest. I want to do my thing and not think about anybody else's issues except for my own. And if I don't want to do any work whatsoever, I shouldn't have to, since I don't get paid for this. As a matter of fact, it's a liability on a daily basis when it comes to time, electricity, cash. It just sucks me dry. So I'm motivated to ignore. I don't know. Some days I just wonder. I wonder what's wrong with me. Researchers in the U.S. have found that when people are told to ignore certain information, it makes them more efficient at performing particular visual tasks. And yeah, like cutting audio, reading, research. You know, when you're interrupted every 10 minutes or whatever, it's very difficult to concentrate. And it's one of the issues that I have, why it's impossible to write any stories, because all day, every day, there's always stuff going on that affects me. I cannot spend an uninterrupted 5 minutes ever. It's probably been at least the last 10 years, I would have to say. No, and then once I got to go up and start being homework helper, forget that, throw it out a window until at least 9:30. And then I might need to close my eyes by that point because I've just had enough of everything. And then try waking up after an hour nap and try and focus. I don't know. It's just, it really seems like I'm a rat in a maze. I'm not getting very far. In the same way that knowing what you're looking for can speed up a search, on the contrary, being aware of what is not of interest is also a case. And, you know, we talked about this too. If you don't find that it's interesting, I mentioned this the other night, you know, and it's not relevant to what you're doing at the time, but you're still kind of having a conversation, you're not always going to remember those details at all. And it's no slight to anybody. It's just that your brain cannot focus on 100 things at once. I'm trying to type something because I want a story here for the end. Individuals who explicitly ignore distractions and distracting information improve their visual search performance, a critical skill for professional searchers like radiologists and airport baggage screeners, says researcher Corbin Cunningham from Johns Hopkins University, where they have the brain database. The work has potential to help occupations that rely on visual search by informing future training programs. Our previous research has found that giving people irrelevant information can slow them down. A new study suggests that when we are given adequate time to learn what we should ignore, it ultimately helps search faster and more efficiently. To test their hypotheses, researchers asked participants to find particular letters among a jumble of characters displayed on a screen. And in some tests, participants were given hints, whatever. I don't know. Why are all these stories like not even interesting today? Are they interesting and it's just me? Or are they just not interesting? And scientists think that this ability to block out extraneous information is crucial to the way we process information. Another study by researchers at the U.S. National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Strokes last year mapped out the circuits in mice brains that are believed to be responsible for ignoring extraneous distractions. And if these circuits are functioning properly, scientists think we do not know what to ignore, and accordingly, we don't know what to pay attention to. So the next time somebody says that you are not paying attention, try to take that as a compliment. After all, it is a necessary counterpoint to our ability to focus on what really matters. Oh, God. Well, is this the news story? I guess it is. February 8th, 2016. I thought the story was a little bit newer. Rescue robots in the shape of a roach. They'll be built just like cockroaches. If you're trapped under a pancake skyscraper after an earthquake or in a mine that had just collapsed, would you be fine with getting rescued by a giant robot cockroach? You know, we talked about that a long time ago, the cockroach robots. And we know that they've been doing all kinds of horrifying experiments, like putting nanofiber wires into them, learning to control them remotely with a joystick, just like they were doing to the soldiers. And then we just read about a disturbing experiment a few weeks ago about them filling the cockroach with nanoparticles, self-replicating nanobots. There was a DARPA article we were reading about. And, I mean, just how horrifying is that? It's still a living creature. Are you going to be okay with being rescued by a giant robot cockroach? What are you going to say? No, thanks. I'm good. Send something fuzzy or cute. Well, I don't think so. It had to be cockroaches. Even if you did request something more charismatic, odds are that it couldn't reach you. American cockroach, says the paper out today, is perfectly adapted for getting into tiny spaces that a human-shaped rescuer might not. And of course, again, the rise of the robots is all about keeping you safe. And now it's all about rescuing you, just like the Atlas bot. The cockroach, it turns out, is a good model for a rescue robot, and it can squeeze into the tiniest little crevices. It'll probably make a really good spy bot too. And that's my comment. All right, guys, well, guess what? We made it through this one. Make sure you stick around. All kinds of great radio live up next. Ms. Lonnie Clark and live radio all weekend, all new shows. All right, guys, make sure you have an awesome weekend, and I will catch up with you on Monday. Everybody take care.